Covering for.
At the end of my posting to Kitui, an opportunity had arisen for me to take a job that was of considerable interest to me, in the sense that they were developing the fisheries. And having spent 2 years as a fisherman in Ireland, between the end of the war and going to Kenya, I thought it was a destiny. It wasn't. It was a failure. And I found myself back as a DO. I was accepted back in again after 4 months, and was posted to the Maasai district, which is where the Maasai Mara is, which has been in the news quite a lot recently. And there I served for another year and a half or so, I think, until 1951-52, and was then posted to a place called Wajir, which is up in the northern frontier, and really quite a despairing place. And being a bachelor, and thinking I'll never have any opportunity of getting married, I accepted an offer by an Italian, Mario Rocco, to work with him on his farm at Naivasha, which was where my parents by then were living. And so I left the administration again to go to this particular job, because, of course, I spoke Italian with him, and his family were Italian. And that is where I was when the emergency was declared.
When was that?
That would have been the end of 1952. Well, I then was for a time at Naivasha. They asked me to become a member of the Kenya Police Reserve, which I did. And then the very amusing thing happened, in that I was called up for the Kenya Regiment. And I replied to them by saying that since I had been granted the right to call myself captain, if they insisted upon me becoming a private in the Kenya Regiment, I would insist on being called Private Captain Campbell. And I think they saw the joke, and so I wasn't called up. But after a period at Naivasha, in which in the Kenya Police Reserve I got quite involved in the early days of intelligence, and met MacDonald from MI5, who came out to organize it. And after a bit in that, which seemed to be getting nowhere, I was quite anxious to, quote, get into the fight again, the same sort of situation as one had been in the period just at the beginning of the war. And so I, so to speak, re-enlisted as a district officer, Kikuyu Guard, which they had then formed to organize the, if you like, resistance against the Mau Mau amongst the Kikuyus themselves, and was posted to Githunguri. And I must say, I greatly enjoyed that. The highlight of that exercise was a chase over the mountains on the day of the Queen's coronation, in the capture of a substantial gang of terrorists.
Can we just pause there, and can you go into the details of that operation against the coronation gang?
Well, it was really disappointing, if you like to say, from the point of view of Blood and Thunder. The extent that I was involved in Mau Mau operations was really not fighting in the sense of the war, because there were very few pitched battles between anybody, either the forces. They were elusive terrorists, if you like, who came down and generally took it out of their own people more than anyone else, and generally got away into the forest. And I don't say that there was nobody shot, but there were never pitched battles. And so what one was doing was getting information from people who would tell you that they'd gone this way or they'd gone that way. And eventually, in this particular, after a big chase up towards the Aberdares, the forest, we succeeded in surrounding them and capturing them. But it wasn't an exciting battle. It was exciting that we were achieving something, but not frightening.
But can you describe their being surrounded and their capture? What are your memories of that?
They're quite ragged in the sense that they came running down. They looked rather pathetic, and they had a whole lot of homemade rifles and things of that sort, and they just sort of came in, and there they were, a whole lot of rather pathetically poorly dressed Kikuyu. There was nothing that lurid. It's disappointing to say this, but it was exciting because we had captured arms and found about a bit more, but we had made an achievement which were few and far between in those days. But to say any more that we were chasing and saying, where have they gone, and we were running ahead and chasing after them, and eventually sighting them, and eventually sending people round the back until they gave up. I can't say any more. My memory, anyhow, doesn't take me any further than that, I'm sorry to say.
About how many did you capture?
Oh, I suppose 30 or 40, something like that.
And do you think any got away?
Oh, I think so, yes. I'm sure they did. Because, after all, there were... I don't know how many. I haven't got or read the books or got the details or seen the official history, but there were quite a few thousand Kikuyu involved in the Mau Mau arm. I like to think of it in terms of the provisional IRA and the IRA, but I mean, if you compare them to the IRA, then there would be several thousand of them up in the forests, and of course hidden in villages where there was either sympathy or fear.
And were they all men, or were there any women?
There were very, very few women terrorists, but undoubtedly the women were the most committed of all, and certainly without the help of the women in bringing them supplies, they would have been defeated much earlier.
How do you mean the women were more committed?
I think that the women were more committed to the Mau Mau cause. The Mau Mau cause, how would I describe this? It's frequently been, by people who write thinking they know about Kenya, it's frequently been presented as a rebellion against British colonial rule, to the extent that obviously there lurked in every colony that we've ever had some desire to have the power that we had. The Kikuyu were destined, in their view, to become the dominating force in the country. And it was for Kikuyu aims alone that they went, and they had few allies. Only the only people who were allied to them at all were the tribes that were very close to them, like the Meru and the Embu, who are almost Kikuyu, their language are practically the same. But beyond those tribes, who were the tribes of the central province, they had no support whatsoever from either the Luo or the Nandi or the Kipsigis or any of the Maasai, for that matter. And so it was a Kikuyu aim which had been fostered over the many, many years by Jomo Kenyatta, who was, as you know, trained in Russia and the London School of Economics.
You are explaining this in connection with why the women should have been more committed.
Well, I'm only saying that it proved to be that they were much more virulent than the men. That is my feeling. and certainly without the loyal support of women bringing them food and helping them with arms and running their ammunition and things of that sort, but they wouldn't have gone on as long as they did. But I've never come across, although I believe there were one or two women in the force itself, so to speak, I've never come across any women, armed women, taking part in anything.
But when you say they were more virulent, would they, you mean in terms of speech, what they would say to you?
Oh, no. No, one never had anybody particularly spitting at you. I've seen them being very tough when being questioned about things. And it was just, it's very difficult to describe, but my very firm belief was that they were dedicated to the cause to a greater extent, perhaps, than men. I'm sorry if I've used something rather loose.
Coming back to the capture of this gang, how were the captives treated?
Oh, they would have been taken back and interrogated and so forth. We didn't have any part of that. That would have been probably done by the Kenya police and the special branch, because there was a Kenya special branch as well, which was the intelligence organization.
But what did you feel about the members of the gang yourself? Was there any hatred on your part?
Oh, no. At this particular stage, I think that the growing feeling that it was something very much bigger and likely to last longer had come about one, but one never felt hatred any more than there was a general dislike for the Kikuyu. The Kikuyu were not liked by most British people, or I mean administrators. I don't say British people, because the Kikuyu formed a huge proportion of the labour on farms in the settled areas, so that you can't say that they were all hated. But we didn't think much of them. The history of Kenya in the past had always shown the Kikuyu to be people who skulked in the woods and used poison and were generally regarded as being cowardly, cunning, perhaps even clever, smart. But to give you the feeling of what it was like, one has to realize that virtually none of the Kikuyu were ever employed in the army or the police, simply because their inferior character, I put that in inverted commas, was regarded, didn't equip them for so doing. And I think by the time we captured the Coronation Gang, which was one of the early successes, if you like, of the Allies against the enemy, one began to realize that they were more determined, that they were really very brave, even though they had done appalling atrocities against their own people, largely. So there wasn't a hatred, and particularly because by the time that this occurred, which would have been, as I said, Coronation Day, which was in the summer of 1953, one had met quite a lot of Kikuyu who were in the Kikuyu Guard, and begun to regard them as being very much more admirable than one had ever thought before. There was exultation over them as captives, but not hatred.
Were they all young men, or were they of different ages?
Oh, virtually all young. I would find it difficult to put an age, because Africans very often don't know their own ages, or didn't in those days. They measured their ages by their circumcision class. That is to say that if they were... my class was called Njane Kanini, which was the little famine, which meant to say that people of that generation had all been circumcised on the same date, and then they had shilingi, which was when they first changed the rupee into the shilling, and so on. So you couldn't tell. But yes, they were young people, because they were living even for people who lived in huts and not a very high standard of living, they were living out in the cold, wet conditions of forest to a large extent, and older men would not have been capable of doing so. And older men had turned against it. It was largely older men who were in the Kikuyu Guard. They were much saner. They may have been emotionally involved in the early days with Kenyatta's ideas, but they were certainly against violence and terrorism.
What was the demeanour of the captives from the Coronation Gang?
That's difficult to remember. I should imagine that they were like, from memory, very much like people who've been captured in any war, sort of dejected but nothing of colossal fear or anything of that sort. But you see pictures of people who've been captured on the Russian front or whatever it is, hopeless and possibly defiant. But you see, they didn't come. This didn't arise. Because we were not doing any interrogation or doing anything of that sort. We were really capturing them and then handing them over to authorities to use for intelligence purposes.
But it was Kikuyu Home Guard who had captured them.
Yes, it was. They would not have been violent towards their own people to a large extent. That is really quite extraordinary, and I think that probably, jumping the gun, if I may, at this stage, because it illustrates the point, I think that the most remarkable thing of everything, because I remained in the central province until the whole thing was over, and we'd begun to see people coming back and being de-oathed as detainees. I think you've heard something about this before. Now, the extraordinary thing was that you would have expected that those people who were loyalists, in quotes, would have spurned or would have been very strongly anti their own people coming back who had been violent, sometimes, supporters of the Mau Mau. But it wasn't, it never happened like that. They were solved quite peacefully without any problem. So very, very difficult to understand the African character. It is not the same as they don't react like Europeans.
You mean not vindictively?
No. They don't appear to be vindictive at all. That doesn't mean to say that they couldn't be violent. The Mau Mau themselves were dedicated to converting by the most violent means possible, and certainly were capable of doing anything to their own people. But what I'm saying is, when it was all over, in spite of the fact that Mau Mau was tarnished, or should have been tarnished in the eyes of the people who had been loyal, they were accepted and absorbed back in without any malice at all, so it seemed.
When did you realise that there was something wrong in the Kikuyu country and that something was brewing? What were the first indications that you had?
Well, of course, you see, I wasn't there when it had all started. I had heard the existence of the word Mau Mau was known quite some time before, that intelligence had got out. So as a district officer, even in the area of the Kamba, which was miles and miles away, one had heard of Mau Mau oaths. Jomo Kenyatta was already a well-known person, largely speaking, making political agitating and this sort of thing, so that it was not surprising at all that the Kikuyu were had a nationalistic movement operating. But it wasn't until various acts of terrorism and things had and the murder in particular of one of the chiefs called Waruhiu, which was the I call the Sarajevo of the Mau Mau emergency, with the killing of Waruhiu, who was regarded as being a very loyal chief and a senior chief of the Kikuyu tribe, That was what provoked the emergency, which then they arrested the principal leaders, including Kenyatta. And that was when the whole thing began. And then murders began in the settled areas, as you know. Leakey murder, the Ruck murder, and various things of that sort. But even that was exaggerated, because there were only 100 Europeans killed. There were 20,000 Kikuyu killed in the emergency. I seem to be now giving you a history of the Mau Mau rather than of myself. But
so, can you tell me about your own work in Kiambu district when you first arrived? What were your first tasks?
Well, I think that there was the most incredible experience that I had, I think, the whole way through, was because the area that I was sent first, before becoming what we call a proper DO, because I ceased to be a DO Kikuyu guard after my first experiences in Kiambu, in that I was moved to the Dagoretti area, where there was a chief called Chief Charles Koinangi Mbiu, and he was a brother of two of the most virulent of the Kikuyu movement. I won't call it the Mau Mau movement, but very, very close associates of Kenyatta, a senior chief Koinangi, who had two sons, John and John Wesley and Peter, both of whom are very clever, well-educated, and very deeply involved. Charles was less deeply involved, but deeply mistrusted by the administration because of his association with the hard core of the whole of the Kikuyu movement, we'll call it. I liked him from the first moment I saw him. And we had one of those feelings of rapport, a rather deep rapport, which I can't describe. And he asked to come and have a private chat with me, and proceeded to tell me the whole story of how he had been interested in himself with Jomo Kenyatta, and thought that Jomo Kenyatta had wanted sensible objectives. But when he realized that all, or this is what he said, you understand, that Jomo Kenyatta really wanted power for himself, and had really, and wealth, and very little interest in the vast majority of people, although he had taken a first oath, which was a relatively mild and not disgusting one at all, he had withdrawn, had not been able to do very much because he was so strongly distrusted by the British, and proceeded to give me information about where people who were likely to be. And we arrested quite a number of people as a result of his information, which was invariably correct. I think Charles vindicated himself completely, perhaps not in the eyes of the first district commissioner, but the second one who came, totally believed, and Charles became, in later life, a provincial commissioner in Nyeri after independence. But that was what happened there, and I think it brought me into a very close relationship of affection to many Kikuyu.
Can you tell me about any things, any incidents that stick out in your mind about acting on the intelligence that Charles Koinangi gave you?
Well, I think it was there as the only time, it can be very luridly described if you like, but it was the only time one night patrol trying to capture a leading light whose name I don't remember, except that his nickname was Footy Saba, which means 7 feet. He was an enormously tall man. He was a very, very virulent Mau Mau, but not a terrorist, because he was quite old, you understand. The elders of the movement didn't generally get involved. And that we set out one evening to seek him. And it's the only occasion that anybody actually fired a shot. It was a shot fired out of a, you could tell this, it was fired out of a homemade gun, because it, you could hear the bullet going. And I remember in the moonlight going in and capturing him. And he was enormously tall. He must have been at least 6'7". And to my amazement, he escaped. I think that was probably the most lurid example that I can think of, the most exciting night.
Why were you so amazed that he escaped?
Well, I didn't think he would be able to. I mean, quite honestly, there we were armed. He wasn't, and he just ran away into the dark.
Where and when was this?
This would have been in the. Where are we now? We went through to 52 weeks. It would have been in the autumn of 1953. That's right, the autumn of 1953. In which I was then moved as a proper district officer in charge of the division of Kikuyu. I think that there's very little else. One did go out looking for people at night. Well, I suppose there's a certain eerie thing about walking about in the moonlight and padding about amongst huts, but one never... There was nothing wildly exciting about the emergency. There may well have been for people like... the Kenya Regiment, working up in the forest. But for a district officer in a residential district, so to speak, in which the principal activity would have been political, and to the extent that it was more than political, it would have been people helping, hiding refugees, giving food to terrorists, giving information to the terrorist organization, you know, terribly like IRA, if you like. It is something that we have sought to do in Ireland, is to try to insulate the population against assisting the IRA, that without safe houses and help of various sorts, they wouldn't succeed. We tried to do this in Kenya as well. But lurid experiences, very few. A feeling that we were getting somewhere, that we were winning, the political battle, or so it appeared, yes, a feeling that it was worthwhile, yes, but in war terms, the only, I would have said, exciting things could be told by the people who operated in the forests.
The position of people like Charles Koinange must have been unenviable if it was known that he was helping you.
Yes, I would think that it pro-